You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 29th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Richard Saunders. Richard, welcome back, man.
Hello, rogues. Hello.
Richard.
How are you doing?
Richard.
Hey, Richard. Hey, I'm doing really well. It's great to be in Sydney, Australia. There's lots of exciting things coming up down under.
Oh, really? Like what?
Anything we'd be interested in?
You guys are coming here. Not only are you going to be in Sydney, Australia for our big convention at the end of November, you're also doing a road trip to our capital, Canberra, to do a night's entertaining there. And then you're going to New Zealand. Man, you guys are going to be jet lagged out of your heads.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be epically bad.
We'll power through.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. It's very exciting indeed for those listeners who don't know, and you must have been living under a rock if you don't know by now. SGU are coming to Australia for the Australian Skeptics National Convention. That's on from the 28th to the 30th of November in the suburb of Chatswood, which is up sort of north of the harbour in Sydney. All the details are at convention.skeptics.com.au. We've got a huge lineup of local and international speakers. Gio will be there, of course. We can't wait to see George Harab. He'll be performing as well. There's an extravaganza night they've arranged for the night of the 28th, which is the first night the convention sort of kicks off, starring the Skeptic's Guide. You've got a dinner coming up. You're doing a live SGU from the convention itself. And that's after you went visit Canberra on a road trip. So this is a really big tour.
You think you can handle it?
No. This is a wonderful chance for Australian listeners to meet all the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and George Rubb, of course. I remember 4 years ago when you were here for TAM Australia, I had the chance to go up and look down on the table area, the merchandise sort of table area, and there were lines of people lining up not only to get Skeptics Guide's t-shirts and whatever, but just to meet you and chat with you. That was quite something.
Yeah, it was a ton of fun.
Yeah, I have to say that trip in particular was amazingly special for me. My wife and I got engaged on that trip. And,
yes. But I must admit, I am very excited because this trip you're doing to Canberra, I'm going to be one of your drivers and my brother Jeff will be the other driver. So it's going to be a hell of a road trip, I think.
Yeah. Wait, so you're actually going to be driving a bus filled with SGU? That's awesome.
Yeah.
are you going to wear like a bus hat?
Oh, a driver's cap. Yeah,
of course. Of course. A little uniform.
And
when we stop along the way, I'll open the door and put my hand out for tips. It's all happening.
Oh,
it's going to be fantastic.
I'm so excited.
You'll be fresh off the plane, so we'll probably all just be sleeping on that trip.
I wouldn't say fresh.
Yeah. Right off the
plane. Richard, do you remember when you picked us up at the airport last time and, you know, literally in that giant bus?
The one thing that I'll never forget. Now, I don't know about what our listeners do, but when I travel internationally or long distances, I dress very casually, very comfortably. You know, I'll put on a sweatshirt and just jeans or something like that. I turn up at the airport to get SGU and Gio off the plane. I'm waiting there. Suddenly, down they come from the ramp. There's Gio looking $1 million in a suit.
Hey.
I mean, the guy is incredible.
Yeah, he is 100% traveling in style and living in style at all times. I know. I really look up to him and the effort it takes. On one of these long trips, like, he's going to have to get dry cleaning done when we're on the trip, right?
Yeah.
Listen, Canberra listeners, people in the Australian Capital Territory and the surrounding areas, come and meet the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe before their big Sydney appearance. All the details are at canberraskeptics.org.au. It should be a great trip.
Although I'm going to be even less fresh than you guys because I'm going to be coming to Australia from Hong Kong.
Well, I don't know. You'll be adjusted for a week, right, Rebecca?
That's true.
I might be in better shape. Let me throw out a quick plug because the tickets for my Hong Kong lecture just went up. So if you're interested in that, if you're in Hong Kong or on the mainland, tickets are on eventbrite.com. You can search for Rebecca Watson Hong Kong or Rebecca Watson Dong Guan, because I'll be there November 20th and November 21st. And then it's off to Canberra.
You may not remember this, but I will. By the time I see you and I hug you and say hello to you when we're in Canberra, I will not have showered for over 2 days.
Yeah, I'm just going to carry a can of Febreze with me, and I'm just going to spray you down before you get close to me.
That's going to be
It's going to look like somebody getting pepper sprayed, but instead of pepper spray, you're going to smell lovely.
To everyone's benefit, believe us.
So this is the sort of entertainment you can expect to see, folks, when you come and see The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe live in Canberra.
We'll be live and pungent. Mm-hmm.
That should be the title of the show. SGU live and pungent.
Live and pungent.
So it's November 1st, and that means it is the anniversary of the opening of the world's first medical school for women. November 1st, 1848, the Boston Female Medical College opened, and 12 women enrolled in the first class, and they graduated 2 years later. Eventually, the college expanded, was renamed the New England Female Medical College, and further on still, it was eventually accepted into Boston University, which is my alma mater. Boston University is not the medical college, obviously, but it was pretty cool because at the time, there was literally nowhere else for women to go if they wanted to study being a doctor.
But Rebecca, women just didn't have the constitution to be physicians.
Right. Because, you know, they've certainly never seen, like, babies being born and things. In fact, that's why the college was started, apparently, because one of the founders thought that it was not right for men to deliver children. So he wanted to train women to do it.
Too lowly a task or something like that?
No. I think it was more in terms of...
Indelicate?
Yeah. Yes, that's a good word for it. Indelicate. Okay. Because women's private parts are not to be seen by strange men. Even if the strange man is, say, saving the woman's life or bringing a child into the world. So
my wife's private parts during the birth of our second child was seen by the entire Hampton Fire Department.
Wow.
Well, why?
Steve, why? Yeah.
Because she delivered at home. Not
did she
purpose.
Sell tickets?
You might as well have. I mean, we unexpectedly delivered our second child at home. And so the Hampton Fire Department nicely showed up to help us out. And there she was on the ground, her legs totally splayed apart with an umbilical cord coming out of her.
Oh, the mental imagery is just fantastic.
Yeah, I'm sure she's really going to appreciate this story, Steve.
Oh, only the pictures.
I have pictures.
Oh, great. Great. I do.
Glossies.
But Steve, you delivered the baby.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So the hospital, the New England Female Medical College, was in fact a school for midwives before becoming a full medical school. So it did come, as Rebecca said, come out of, you know, teaching women how to deliver babies. Did you also read, Rebecca, that it absorbed the local homeopathic hospital?
Yes.
And a lot of the first students were homeopaths. Mm-hmm. And they practiced homeopathy. It was part of the curriculum. It was, this is talking about the middle of the 1800s. I mean, yeah, there's not a lot of effective medical knowledge at that time.
Right. Yeah. This was at the height of homeopathic usage in a way. And during those early years where it could have still been beneficial because you're essentially doing nothing rather than causing harm accidentally.
So do you want to hear how far women have come in medical school?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So there were 17,364 medical students graduated in 2011. Their numbers are slightly higher in the few years since then. What percentage do you think were male versus female?
For 2011?
Yep.
30 to 70%.
52% female.
I would think slightly under 50. I was going to think 45.
Yeah, it's like 45, right. It's 8,968 men, 8,396 women. So almost at parity. Hmm. Not quite. Women are just a little bit less than men. The numbers for 2013 are very similar. I haven't seen 2014 numbers. But that's steadily increasing also. I mean, if you project out, the women will overtake men in a few years, you know, even if you project out the numbers.
I think that within different disciplines, there's still a good deal of not much balance. Why can't I think of words to
not have way, I guess. By subspecialty, there are definitely male dominated and female dominated subspecialties. There isn't equal numbers choosing to go into every type of specialty. You know, more women go into pediatrics, more men go into neurosurgery. Yet that's changing as well.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Well, we have some great news items coming up. Bob is working late today. That happens occasionally. He has to do what he calls a deploy, which is some software thing. Jay, you know about that, right?
Yeah. And there, you know, the fact that he said he almost could make it was impressive because usually there's no chance.
Yeah. I don't think he's going to make it, but he might. If he finishes in time, he will join us later in the show. Otherwise we will soldier on without him. We're going to start with a stem cell story. This one is pretty cool. So researchers at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute recently published a paper, which is a proof of concept study. They're just showing that this approach may work. What they did was they programmed stem cells to produce a cytotoxin, which is capable of killing cancer cells. And actually, the cytotoxin itself would kill any cell, you know, pretty much. But they linked it to a carrier that is specific for a protein on the surface of cancer cells, specifically brain cancer cells. So in other words, this cytotoxin, this toxin that would cause a cell to die, it actually shuts down the cell's protein production and the cell dies in about 2 to 3 days. That this toxin will only get into cancer cells because the carrier that it's attached to will only bind to this receptor that is only found on cancer cells and not on healthy cells. So they designed these stem cells to essentially produce this carrier and cytotoxin. And they also had to engineer the stem cells to be resistant to the cytotoxin itself. So they won't die. You know, they won't kill themselves by producing the cytotoxin. So they successfully did that. So now they got these stem cells that are essentially cancer killers and, but will be able to survive themselves. They used a mouse model of, was it mouse or rat? I always get those two little buggers mixed up.
Mouse rat.
Yeah, it was a rodent model.
Yeah, rodentia.
So they took a mouse model of brain cancer, and then when the mice developed brain tumors, they would remove the tumor, which is what you would do in a human. And then, but the problem is, of course, that even when you remove as much of the tumor as you can, you're really just debulking it. You're not removing all of it. You don't get clean margins. So there's still cancer left behind. So, but then they put these stem cells into the resection cavity, you know, into the surgical area. And the stem cells survived. They cranked out the cytotoxin. They killed cancer cells. And the mice that had the stem cells survived longer.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah. That's a very exciting treatment. It's always exciting to have a completely new approach. But how long do you think it's going to take to develop this?
5 to 10 years.
Absolutely. 5 to 10 years. Mm. But this is as close to being in the pipeline as we can get, but not quite. Because the thing is, you just don't know what's going to happen when we start to test this in humans. You know, the possible downsides are that the cells could survive, produce cytotoxin, kill cancer cells, but just not do it enough to affect survival. Or the cells themselves can cause problems. The stem cells, you know, they're tricky little buggers. They can sometimes grow out of control themselves. So, you know, we'll need to do careful human trials to see what the net effect is on survival and, you know, what's happening when we implant these stem cells into people who've recently had a brain tumor removed, but probably have some of the cancer still left behind. Like a glioblastoma. That's the most common brain cancer. It's horrible. Actually, our uncle died of a glioblastoma maybe about 10 years ago. It's just, you know, one of those tumors where despite all of our efforts, you know, we've increased survival a little bit, but not dramatically.
Have stem cells been engineered to do this sort of carrier task before, or is that what's entirely new about this?
No, that's not entirely new. This is a very interesting approach that researchers have been looking at in many contexts. So I do find that's interesting. I think when most people think of stem cells, and just for a very quick review, a stem cell is a basic cell that can turn into other kinds of cells. There are various different types of stem cells. An embryonic stem cell can turn into any other kind of cell in the body. an adult-derived stem cell can turn into many different kinds. If it's like what we call pluripotent, it can turn into many different kinds. Totipotent means it can turn into any different kind. Stem cells are a good raw material that, you know, if we can get them to turn into the type of cells that we want, then they could replace damaged or diseased cells. So that's, I think, what most people think of when they think of stem cell therapy. Oh, your brain cells are dying. We're going to inject your brain with stem cells and they're going to turn into healthy cells and replace the dying cells or the diseased cells or your heart or your liver or whatever. And that certainly is one of the theoretical applications of stem cells, but it's not the only one. You can also engineer stem cells to be essentially drug factories, to produce and secrete a drug in place, like in the tissue, in a steady rate. This is especially good for drugs that you can't take in pill form because they're protein-based or they would be digested or they wouldn't be bioavailable. Not all things can survive and be absorbed, you know, through the gastrointestinal tract. Those kind of drugs you would have to inject somewhere. But it could be tricky to get drugs into the brain. And that's the big problem with cytotoxic therapies for brain cancers, that it's just hard to get the chemical into the brain. Well, this way, you take out the tumor, and before you close up, you put the stem cells in there, they secrete the drug right there, right into the brain, right next to the cancer cells. So it's an excellent drug delivery system. Another related type of use of stem cells would be engineering them to be support cells. So for example, if you have brain cells dying for whatever reason, you could engineer astrocytes to keep those cells alive. So you're not replacing the cells. You're just, you know, helping keep the cells alive longer so that it slows the progression of the disease down. So that would be a similar type of effect. And usually that would involve engineering the stem cells to secrete something like a hormone or whatever that's going to support or those cells or keep them alive. In this case, you're engineering them to secrete a toxin to kill cancer cells. So it's a great potential use of stem cells. And we're right on the cusp, you know, of this potential. But it just takes a long time to do careful clinical trials. Even if all goes well, you know, maybe we're 10 years away from patients actually getting this therapy. That's still great, but that's if everything goes well. If we run into some hiccups, it could be a lot longer.
Steve,
and you can't predict the outcome of trials. That's why you have to do them.
Steve, do you understand what's going on when you have a stem cell? Is it some type of outside stimulation or stimuli turn it into a particular cell? Like, how does it know what cell to turn into and how does it turn into another cell?
It's essentially responding to chemical hormonal triggers in the environment. And that's what the researchers have to figure out. What triggers do they have to give to the stem cells to coax them into turning into the type of cells that they want? And what's happening is you're turning on and turning off of genes because every cell has the entire DNA, you know, for the whole person to make every other kind of cell. But if, like, a liver cell, for example, has only the liver genes turned on and not the other ones. Genes that are specific for brain cells are turned off in liver cells. A stem cell has the potential to go down multiple different pathways to develop into specific kinds of cells that are expressing genes for that cell population to differentiate, we call it.
Think about how wonderful that is.
Yeah.
And how incredible that what you just said is, that that's built into every cell in our body.
Yeah, well, it's got to be because we start as one cell and turn into a whole person. So it's got to work that way, right?
Thank you for saying I'm a whole person.
Well,
it is absolutely staggering. And it reminds me of stem cells is a classic example of a relatively new discovery or technology, we might be able to say, that is hijacked by the woo crowd. Yeah. And I remember about 10 years ago, there was a woman in somewhere in Sydney who set up shop saying that she could grow women's breasts bigger by hypnotizing their stem cells.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Wow.
Now
one of
that's...
our people go in, we had one of our people at the time go in undercover, so to speak, to be hypnotized to grow bigger breasts, but it didn't work, sadly.
He's very
didn't
sad.
Didn't work.
About
I'm shocked. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it didn't work, unfortunately. I should be careful what I say here, but it just didn't work.
Yeah, but just keying into the latest buzzword and throwing it out there, hoping
Absolutely.
That people don't know enough to realize that it's total BS. Were they quantum stem cells?
Not at that stage. Quantum yeah, right. is quantum's fad. I must think is on the wane because I was at the Mind Body Spirit Festival, as we call it, Mind Body Wallet, last weekend, and I think I saw only one or two uses of the word quantum.
Yeah.
Whereas 5 or 6 years ago, it was common to see the quantum technology or a quantum thing in this. But yeah, the woo crowd love to pick up on the latest discoveries or buzzwords and incorporate it and say, "Well, that's what we've been doing for years," and so on.
Yeah. Vibrations has been a popular one. That still
always
sounds popular.
Always,
yeah. Yep. Energy. Yeah. Just the
energy
more basic
always.
Ones. Yep. Yeah. Your vibrations are going to resonate with the inherent energy of the universe.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah. All right. Evan, I understand, just a couple years ago, we talked about Baumgartner's record, Felix Baumgartner.
That's right.
Didn't last for long, did it?
No, it didn't. Bob referred to him, and as other people did, as Fearless Felix, for having jumped in October of 2012, and he had set the skydive record, jumping from a dizzying height of 128,100 feet. Whoa. The record that he broke was 52 years old. It was Joe Kittinger in 1960. So that record lasted 52 years it took to break that record. And here we are 2 years later, and Fearless Felix's record has gone down. Well, at least one of his records. It was Alan Eustace, mm-hmm. whom I had really not heard about before. He is a executive vice president of knowledge at Google. He's also an engineer and a pilot and a skydiving enthusiast. He jumped from an incredible height of 135,890 feet. That is about almost 1.5 miles higher than Felix's jump.
Wow.
41.5 kilometers.
Now you're talking my language.
Stunning.
Thank
yes,
you.
which is stunning.
And the language of many of your listeners, so there you go.
I know.
Yay, metric system. Sorry, go on.
So did he have Red Bull or whoever sponsoring it? Or like it seemed,
no.
It was such a huge deal with Felix Baumgartner, but now this just seems
That's
to
right.
have come out of nowhere.
That's right. I only read about it and heard about it after it happened. It was reported later that day that it actually happened. And I think a lot of people were caught by surprise. You're right. Felix's jump, was sponsored by Red Bull, and there was a lot of hype, leading up to it. And, certainly sponsors, the Red Bull sponsorship, probably among others were, all really had a lot invested in this. But no, Eustace, decided to just take a much more, low-key approach to this. That's not to say that there weren't some, other interested parties or corporations involved with this. Eustace was wearing the Start X, which is the Stratospheric Explorer suit. It's a fully self-contained spacesuit and recovery system, not unlike the spacesuits used on the Apollo missions or used at the International Space Station. They were the ones, who, corporate-wise, who had a kind of investment in this. But no, you're right, Rebecca. It wasn't advertised. It was done, but at the same now they're. After it's happened, Arizona-based Worldview Enterprises plans to utilize the same technology that Eustace used when they begin transporting tourists for short jaunts into space in late 2016. And skydiving from those altitudes may soon become the new must-do adventures for those who can maybe afford to take that kind of trip. But there may be a future market here that has opened up as all these emerging, technologies. People going into plausibility of average people being able to access the lower, the upper atmosphere, low space elevation, and doing things like jumping. Mm-hmm. So very, very cool. Hey, did you know the suit weighs 400 pounds?
Wow. I believe it.
Oh. 400 pounds.
So you're pretty much screwed if you land in water or something.
Yeah. It took Eustace a while to learn how to sort of move around in the high pressure suit. Who knew that something like that would actually weigh that much?
Yeah, if you watch the video of him when he lands, he basically just flops right down on his face and rolls over. He does like a somersault. He had really no control.
Oh, I thought it was strange why he landed that way. Oh, that is really cool.
I think he was landing with a 400-pound suit. Yeah, it's amazing.
The suit wins at that point. You know, you're going to go, the suit takes over.
It's quite a bit of momentum there to deal with.
He did not break, he did break the sound barrier during his fall. So the first 4.5 minutes of his fall were just free fall, no parachute or deployed or anything like that. He reached Mach 1.23. That's 822 miles per hour. 822 miles per hour. And like I said, set off a small sonic boom, which was heard by people on the ground.
That's 1,322 kilometers per hour.
Wow. And incidentally, the suit weighed 181.437 kilos. That's staggering. That's just amazing.
Thank you, Richard. I'm so glad you're here to do this for me.
And it's all right. A lot of the listeners just realized how heavy the suit was. That's quite all right.
So how long until that record is broken, do you think?
That's the next question. I don't think it's going to be 52 years, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, tied in with the technologies that's going to, like we mentioned before, make space, you know, high areas of the atmosphere accessible to people. There should be, you know, in the next few years, some more attempts like this. And I don't think Alan Eustace would have any problem with that whatsoever. In fact, you know, he's probably going to be looked at as one of the great ambassadors to this sort of experience as history will tell.
I wonder if we're going to run up against any kind of limitation in terms of getting to that height, because primarily he's using a helium filled balloon. How much, you know, and the higher you get, the less lift you're going to get out of the helium, because the less of a differential there's going to be in terms of the pressure. So I wonder how high you can go with a helium balloon.
With a helium balloon. Yeah, that's the point. I believe the record for a helium balloon elevation is about 170,000 feet. There was a Japanese company that sent it up. It was unmanned, of course, but you can apparently go to there with the helium balloon at least. So we've got, you know, another four, that's about 5 more miles of height that you could probably achieve. And I'll bet you it'll happen in a couple of years.
Would you do it, Evan?
No, I wouldn't. I'm not great with heights as it is. You know, I won't say I have a fear of heights, but it's not the most comfortable sensation. Bob skydove at least once. I recall seeing a picture of him. I was going to ask him if this was something he would do. And I think he would say something like this. Hell yeah.
Yeah, he would.
It's a good Bob impression.
At that height, though, do you even perceive the height? You know what I mean? You're so far up that I wonder if you get the same reaction. Like if you're a couple hundred feet off the ground, you could see that you're at a dangerous height.
Well, at some point during the dive, you do get to that height. So
that's true. But by then, hopefully your parachute has opened and you feel more secure, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
I think it's fantastic that people are doing these types of feats. For some reason, just reminds me or makes me think of the fact that, space travel is being commercialized as well. You know, these things are reachable now. People are achieving these incredible, you know, that's almost like a sport if you think about it.
You guys hear about the Antares rocket that took off on a resupply mission to the International Space Station?
Yeah.
Well, I think I heard the explosion from here.
Yeah. Didn't make it.
I mean, it's good there's nobody on board at least.
It was unmanned, right. But it is always unfortunate when we lose a rocket. The video is incredible though. You know, you see the rocket launch normally, but only for a few seconds, 3, 4, 5 seconds. And then, the exhaust sort of flares out and there's the first stage. There's clearly an explosion and the rocket loses momentum entirely and then starts to fall back down onto the launch pad, and then there's a massive explosion. So there is something about watching the rocket completely lose momentum and start to fall back. It's like it feels so wrong.
Yeah, definitely.
I experienced a sensation for a quick moment similar to when I saw the footage of the Challenger explosion in 1986.
Wasn't that
sort of
bad.
That same formation. No, it wasn't that bad, but it's kind of that same formation of the cloud and how the particles sort of spread out from the center of the explosion. It's just for a quick second. I don't think you can really help but think of that at the moment. And so it sent a little chill up my spine in that regard.
It was very unfortunate. Yes, I was very sad to see that. Luckily, no one died, of course, but it's not a good thing. But what one of the videos from the event that really took my attention was some people videoing some distance away from it. The thing blows up, and they're shouting, brace yourself or look out, because they know the shockwave's coming.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to be in that situation, to see something like that, and the anticipation knowing that any second now you're going to be hit by the wall of sound and the shock from the explosion. That's just, that would be mind-blowing, I think.
So there is some good news that, first of all, the station is not at risk of, you know, with the loss of those supplies. They have several months of supplies, and there are other supply missions planned. And in fact, just this morning, a Russian Soyuz rocket successfully launched with a resupply mission to replace the one that was lost.
That's good.
You mean they launched a rocket that quick, Steve?
Yeah. Yeah.
They must have those things ready, you know, at least one ready to go at any moment. I think, don't they have one poised in case there's an emergency and they have to evacuate the people from the ISS? I think
they have capsules on the station. Yeah. But this was a planned resupply that they just moved up. They moved the schedule up. And then the next resupply is a SpaceX Dragon mission, actually. That's in a few weeks. Yeah, there's enough redundancy, I think, in the resupply missions that the loss of one rocket isn't a threat to the mission, you know, in the International Space Station. Still, you know, always a concern when we see that happen. $200 million rocket.
Oh, God, that's so bad. I know, it's terrible, but
ouch.
It's a reminder that this stuff is very dangerous. You know, we're starting to think about space travel as a given, and it truly isn't a given. It's incredibly difficult, even today. It's incredibly expensive, and it's very traumatic when something like this happens. I mean, I watched that video a few times today, and every time I just want a different outcome. You know, I just don't want to believe that it happened.
The engines on the rocket, they're called AJ-26 engines. They're relics from the 1970s, built in the Soviet Union, part of the secret canceled Russian program to land on the moon. Hmm. So we're reusing 40-year-old technology here.
They were refurbished, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, one of our writers that writes for us on the SGU news page has an inside track, and she is right now doing an investigation to try to get us some exclusive info on what actually happened with the rocket and what the real circumstances were, because according to her, some of the news wasn't completely accurate. So you can look for that on the SGU news page. Yeah.
Yeah. If we get anything really good, we'll talk about it next week on the show. All righty. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about the new Pope, Pope Francis, and his views on science.
I wonder how long Pope Francis has to be Pope before he's no longer considered the new Pope.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a while, right? and yet still he lives in Pope Benedict's.
That's funny. Shadow. We were younger. We built an addition onto our house, and we called it the new room because it was new. We called it the new room for 30 years.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. You named it, and that was that.
Yeah.
And you never built another new room.
It was always the newest room in the house.
Yeah. Yeah, so Pope Francis will be the new pope until the next pope, and then he'll be the old pope. He'll maybe be he'll probably be known as the progressive pope. And, you know, as popes go. And true to that stereotype about him, he has made a decree that, guess what? Evolution and the Big Bang are true. So
thank goodness for that.
Yeah. Oh, so welcome to.
So the scientists were finally right.
Welcome to this century. He specifically said that God is not a magician with a magic wand. He says that.
That's Harry Potter.
Right. That's Harry Potter. He's often confused with God. When people read the account of creation in the Bible, and he's basically just pointing out the obvious that, the Genesis creation story is not a word for word truth, which, you know, is so obvious and dumb, but this is what we expect now. Like, this is the best thing that a religious leader can come out with, is to come out and say, hey, these, scientific theories that have been confirmed by scientists for, at least a century, are, they're okay. They're science. We can believe in them. I do wish that other religious leaders would follow suit, because the Catholics actually aren't that into denial of evolution or the Big Bang. It hasn't been a part of official Catholic doctrine for quite a long time, I believe.
Yeah, they're not fundamentalists.
Right. For the most part, previous popes have also been okay with evolution and the Big Bang theory. Benedict did say some dumb things about intelligent design and how evolution in the neo-Darwinian sense is not true. So, yeah, Francis is doing one better on Benedict. But yeah, you look back at the history of Catholicism and it just isn't that big of a deal. In fact, the guy who's known as the father of the Big Bang, Georges Lemaître, was a priest. He was a Catholic priest, and he came up with the idea of the cosmic egg, which later on was termed the Big Bang. And as far as I know, he was never defrocked for that. So, yeah, it's nice to see the Pope speaking up for scientific fact in the face of so much BS that religion can get itself into. But at the same time, this isn't really the biggest news in religious history, as some people are celebrating.
Yeah, I mean, it really isn't. Because, again, the Catholic Church is not a fundamentalist, you know, dogma. And of course, you know, some people were saying, yeah, but he's still saying God created man. Of course he is. He's the goddamn Pope.
Right.
Of course he believes in God. You know, I mean, what do you expect? It's still, so essentially, you know, he's staking out a position of theistic evolution where, yes, the Big Bang happened, evolution happened, but God wanted it to happen. He made it happen. That's the unfalsifiable, interpretation. But fine. Good. Just stay out of the way of science. You can believe whatever you want, you know, in terms of your faith and the metaphysics, but he's saying that we're not going to contradict proven science. That's a good strategy for religions, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's a losing strategy to say our faith is completely different than what the scientists say. You set up a necessary conflict there that in the long run you're not going to win, you know?
Yep. Yeah, the more they dig their heels in, science will win.
Yeah.
It will eventually win. So get with the program. Adapt or die.
But guys, you know, be positive about this too. You know, I know that we could be even critical when something good happens, but it's really awesome that the Pope is taking things in that direction. And it shows that he's a forward thinker and that he's got a head on his shoulders. You know, this isn't someone, look, even on something like this, I really am surprised by it.
Well, Jay, this is actually, remember Pope John Paul II was even a little bit more specific about saying evolution is proven. It's proven fact. I mean, he just came right out and said it. Benedict walked it back a little bit, flirting with the whole intelligent design nonsense. And now this guy, what's
Francis.
His name?
Francis.
Yeah, now
new Pope.
The new Pope Francis.
New Pope. The new Pope.
He's returning more to where John Paul was. So it's actually not that mind blowing, as Rebecca was saying.
Well, it is to me, damn it.
Did you? I hate to throw cold water on the plus marks that Pope Francis is going to get. We have to give him a minus as well. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least mention this. The other headline regarding Pope Francis this week gives blessing to exorcist conference.
Yeah.
300 Catholic exorcists meeting in Rome this week ahead of All Saints Day.
Never mind.
And according to Francis, quote, they are helping those who suffer because of the work of the devil.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, so what do you do in a case like this? So he's okay. He's a little better as far as evolution goes, but he's still clinging on to things like exorcism.
Yep.
There are still some medieval ideas in there.
Okay. Well, all right. Fine. 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 Thanks, Ed. I got it.
I said that it was going to be cold water. I'm sorry. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that.
All right, Richard, I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
When you douse, you know, engage in dowsing in Australia, do you have to hold the stick upside down?
No, you have to be upside down.
Okay.
Mm. Oh, that makes sense.
But the stick should be right side up.
Sticks right side up.
Okay.
You stand on your head, you get your friends to hold you up by your feet, and you walk along that way. It all works. Mm-hmm. It's all fine.
Richard, even more amazing, that joke is still funny to Steve after about, what, 7 years?
Well, it depends. I mean, from my point of view, sitting here in Sydney, Australia, you guys are all upside down.
It's all relative.
Mm-hmm. It is. Is this a segue, Steve?
That's a segue, yes. Richard.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's a segue.
You can be forgiven for not recognizing it.
That's all right. Segues here are upside down, too. It's quite remarkable.
What a segue
it is, because I have to tell you, we had a bit of a giggle here at Australian Skeptics in the last week. The incoming head of the CSIRO, now for those people who don't know, the CSIRO stands for the Commonwealth Science and Industrial Research Organization. This was founded in 1926. It's about as old as James Randi. It's one of Australia's most respected scientific institutions, and they've been responsible in the past for helping to invent things like polymer banknotes, for example, and they're generally regarded as good, solid scientists doing good, solid science, as Australia is very proud of them. So with some disbelief that the incoming head of this organization went on radio just the other week, his name is Dr. Larry Marshall, saying that he wishes or is interested in conducting research, presumably using very hard to get scientific funding in Australia these days, into water divining.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the sort of news you had to think, no, hang on. Can I hear that again? Or someone's pulling my leg, or this is from The Onion. Sadly, it's all true. It's on the public record there. If you just Google CSIRO and water divining, you can see the story. It's quite astonishing from our point of view, because this is something that has, and we don't like to use this term generally, but it has been debunked, and it's been debunked for many years, especially here in Australia, thanks to people like James Randi, who was here in 1980, conducted some very famous water divining tests. No one passed. We at Australian Skeptics have been conducting significant tests ever since. It doesn't pass. And here's a guy who's going to take over one of the most respected scientific outfits in the country, saying things like, he's seen people do this with close to 80% accuracy, and I have no idea how they do it, he said. This is very concerning for us. So it's been widely tweeted and Facebooked and blogged about. I think he probably has got the message by now, but would be interested to see what happens from here on in. However, he has won himself a nomination for the Australian Skeptics Bent Spoon Award. And this is awarded annually at our national convention. So you'll be there for the awarding of this. We don't know who's going to win yet, but he's a strong contender. And this is for the most preposterous piece of paranormal or pseudoscientific piffle. Past winners have included Merrill Dorey from the Australian Vaccination Network and somebody called Fran Sheffield, who runs an outfit called Homeopathy Plus, who this year have been lobbying the World Health Organization to include homeopathy as a preventative for Ebola. So we've got quite a lineup, but this whole water divining thing has just got us in, well, simultaneously in fits and giggles, but also a little bit sad and dismayed that somebody who has obviously got the job and is going to be taking over in January doesn't even know that water divining has been thoroughly debunked and is interested in spending government money on it. It's quite staggering.
So even though this guy hasn't done research for a while, he was a trained physicist. You know, this guy has
it's even more surprising.
Has a science background. But this is yet another example, and we see this all the time, that being a scientist and having a degree doesn't necessarily mean that you have the full suite of critical thinking skills. And scientists get bamboozled, get fooled by this sort of thing all the time, fooled into thinking that ESP is real, or that near-death experience is real, or that psychics are real, or that dowsing is real, because they get fooled by the magic tricks and they don't realize, you know, how it's all working. But what's interesting always to see is, you know, how will Larry Marshall respond to this feedback? Will he go, okay, wait a minute, maybe I was premature, maybe I got to take another look at this, look at the actual science, listen to the skeptics, and then make a correction, or was he going to dig in his heels?
Yeah, we're hoping he will. We're hoping he'll realize and look at what we've sent him, all the videos, all the research and, numerous tests. I even sent, there's a wonderful video of Alan Alda, the wonderful Alan Alda doing a water divining test for American, Scientific Frontiers, I think. So if he does, then all credit to him. Good on him. That's just the sort of thing we'd like to see. It is slightly surprising that a man heading up such an august, body would consider water divining something worth chasing up. But yes, that remains to be seen.
But what's disappointing is that he didn't vet it first. You know, it's the process. Yeah. It's not that he was fooled. Anybody can be fooled, right? But it's that in his position as a public scientist about to head up a scientific organization that he came out with this without doing a little bit of background research, seeing what's out there. It shouldn't have taken him too long to realize that this was controversial at best, total bunk in actuality. So that's a bad sign, I think.
It is, but again, you know, we'll see what he does.
Yeah. And we'll give him a chance.
We'll give him a chance. We all drop clangers. We all make stupid mistakes in our life, and maybe he'll come to see that. And if he does, then pull back and say, well, I've seen this now, then we'll be very, very happy with that and give him credit.
Yeah, it's totally fixable. He's still at a stage where he can say, okay, was unfamiliar with it. I spoke out of turn. Now I've been shown what's reality and fine. I'll listen to the science. He could completely fix this at this point. But you know what people generally do? They generally dig in their heels and make it a million times worse.
We hope not. But yes, that does happen. People don't want to lose face.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Richard. All right, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thanks, Doctor. I'm going to go ahead and play last week's Who's That Noisy as a reminder. See if you recognize this voice.
This is a new and strange environment at first. This suddenly finding yourself in orbit.
That some astronaut?
Yeah, not many people in life have been in orbit, per se. And definitely an astronaut. Ever heard of Gordon Cooper?
Yeah, Gordy Cooper.
Leroy Gordon Gordy Gordo Cooper Jr. better known as Gordon Cooper.
He had the right stuff, that guy.
He definitely did. Yes. One of the seven original astronauts in Project Mercury, the first manned space program of the United States. And a very nice, clean audio cut from way back when, around the time of the Mercury projects, and courtesy of NASA. Thank you, NASA, for putting that out there for the public.
Very cool.
Correct answers, yes, there were several. There can be only one winner each week. We have Eric Miller is the winner for this week. Well done, Eric.
Good job. No NIM, huh? Just a regular old name.
That's it. Usually when they email in, they don't have anything fancy. It's the correct answers on the message boards that
get the very
interesting names and handles and all that. All right, so moving on. Here we have a noise. Brand new Who's That Noisy for this week. Well, it sounds interesting. Let's see if you guys can identify this.
Cool.
Maybe you heard this somewhere else before. Maybe earlier in your life at some point you heard this, and it sounds darn familiar. So give it a guess and let us know what you think. The email address is WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or go ahead and post it on our boards, our forums, which is sguforums.com. Good luck, everybody.
Thank you, Evan. All right, we have a Name That Logical Fallacy this week. Richard, have you ever played Name That Logical Fallacy before?
Not on SGU, but I love logical fallacies because there are so many of them and they're sometimes interchangeable and sometimes they're a bit gray around the edges. It's a fascinating study.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important to recognize that logical fallacies, that the ones that we talk about are informal logical fallacies, meaning that they're very context dependent. And they can be fuzzy around the edges and sort of merge into each other. It's just a way of recognizing how to keep your thinking valid and legitimate, and not to fall for some for common pitfalls. But they're not strictly like if you make this kind of argument, it's always wrong. It's just that you got to be wary of making these kinds of arguments. Anyway, we got a question that comes from Chase in Japan, and Chase runs a YouTube channel, and he is sending us a comment that was said to one of his YouTube videos. So I'm just going to read the comment that he sent to us for our analysis to see if we can identify the logical fallacies here. The commenter writes, "Yes, a percentage of UFO videos and pictures are faked or photoshopped, but dude, really? There are thousands of videos and more of them in daylight and close up. Just the law of averages with thousands of them means that there are real craft. They do perform things that cannot be done with any current public technology and cannot be done with any materials we have with our present understanding of physics. A human body would not survive the maneuvers performed. Just go to the Disclosure Project website and read the affidavits from hundreds of upper U.S. and global military and scientists working on government black ops projects. You need to catch up."
Right.
All right. Want to let's unpack this a little bit.
I've got, just off the top of my head, just listening to that, I've got begging the question, straw man, and appeal to authority.
He's good, Steve. He's good. We're going to let him stay.
Think so? Yeah, there are others too.
No doubt, but just hearing that, and I had a quick look before, yeah.
I agree. I totally agree. Why, anyone want to throw any others out?
And then we'll go. Is there an argument from popularity here?
Yeah. A bit.
Just the law of averages with thousands of them means that they're a real craft.
Which sort of can be blended into an appeal to authority. So, yes, I guess you could see both happening there.
Well, let's go through sentence by sentence a little bit. So he acknowledges that there can be, that some of the photos are faked, but because there are so many of them, some of them must be real. That's basically his argument. They can't all be faked, but that's, I think, Richard, where you were begging the question, right?
I think so, yeah.
Why can't they all be fake? Well, that's an assumption. That's a premise that you're taking there. If some of them can be fake, why can't all of them be fake?
Yeah, yeah.
And if a lot of them are fake, why can't thousands of them be fake? There's always this hidden assumption of the more there are, then eventually some of them have to be real, but that's just not valid. That is not true.
Absolutely. And we hear this, many times, especially with UFOs, but, strangely enough, in this country, we have a creature supposedly called the Yowie, which is the Australian version of the Bigfoot. And it's sighted down the whole, side of this country.
Yeah.
I mean, over thousands and thousands and thousands of kilometers, people say they've seen it. And the argument is, well, it's seen so often, they can't all be wrong. I bet, okay, 80% are false, but you know that other 20%, I bet they're real Yowie. So it's the same sort of argument.
Yeah, it's the residue argument, as I've called it, that whenever you have any phenomenon like that, Bigfoot sightings, Yowie sightings, UFO sightings, whatever, and then you can show the ones that you can investigate, you can always show that they're either fake or misidentified. And then the believers will say, this is also special pleading. They'll say, okay, those were fake, but there are so many of them, even if just 5% are true, then something is going on. It's like, well, yeah, but that's the rub, right? That is the question. Are any of them at all true? Until you have any that have been demonstrated to be verifiably true, you've really ruled out other possibilities, or you have some genuine, you know, anomalous phenomenon, there's no reason not to think that they're all fake. Okay, let's move on. They do perform things that cannot be done with any current public technology. What mental error is he making there?
Oh, that's when I heard that originally, that's when the straw man came to mind. He's putting up a bogus argument like that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, he's not putting that argument into the mouth of somebody else. He's it's more that, again, there's a hidden assumption there. He's assuming – this is a begging the question. This is when I thought you were begging the question.
That's why sometimes in my mind they get a little bit interchangeable.
Yeah, so a straw man is when – it's not that you're just misstating a point. It's that you are mischaracterizing your opponent's position in order to make it easier to argue against. Yeah. Rather than giving them the courtesy of, you know, being charitable to an interpretation of their position. In this case, however, what he's saying is, this is the hidden assumption, the hidden premise here. If you interpret these videos as if they are UFOs, then they are doing things that no aircraft can do. But again, that's the very question.
Mm.
One, it's possible that they're fake, in which case, but then who cares what they're doing? Mm-hmm. Two, it's possible that they're misidentified. It's possible, for example, that we're seeing something small close to the camera and therefore not moving that fast.
Like a bug.
Like a bug in
like
some
bug.
Cases.
It comes or up a bird. Lot, yeah.
And therefore, it's not performing things that can't be done with current technology, right? So he's hinging his argument on the premise that his conclusion is already true. That's a begging the question. Right. Same thing with the materials, you know, human body. That's all part of that same argument. Then the reference to the Disclosure Project, which is, you know, UFO proponents have put together a list of people who are in a position where you might think that they have some authority, or some expertise. And their anecdotes about UFOs. So that's the argument from authority that you're referring to, Richard. That
yeah.
We have military scientists. Well, you know, military scientists can be wrong, you know. you still need to give me evidence. You need some objective, verifiable evidence. Anecdotes, you know, from people who, even if they're scientists, even if they're pilots, they still have human brains. As we just saw with the physicist who thinks dowsing is real, you know, people have, they have holes in their critical thinking skills. It doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't. It's, but that is so common for people to be very, very impressed with the credibility of the person stating the anecdote. It really, you're trying to establish that aliens are visiting the Earth. You're going to have to do better than that.
Well, it's why celebrities endorse products. People like authority figures or celebrity figures and tend to believe what they say.
Right. Exactly. All right, guys, well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. And we have four items just to make it especially
great.
an extra chance to be wrong. Yay.
We have a sort of a Halloween theme.
I like that.
Oh.
These are four items that are all archaeological horror stories.
Good heavens.
You have to tell me which one of these four archaeological horror stories is not true. So are you ready, children?
Yeah.
Gather around the campfire. I'm going to tell you some ghost stories. Ready?
Yes.
Horror story number one. In the El Cedron cave in Spain, archaeologists found the remains of 12 Neanderthals, three children, three teenagers, and six adults. All 12 were killed, butchered, and eaten raw by other humans.
Oh, no.
Horror story number two. Italian Egyptologist Girolamo Sagatto discovered a method for preserving flesh by turning it into stone. His process of petrification from almost 200 years ago remains a mystery and has never been duplicated. Horror story number three. Don't get too scared, Richard. Are you okay over there?
Yeah, I've got Fred.
Okay.
He's with
all right.
Me. Fred, it's all right.
All right. Archaeologists examining the prehistoric remains of dozens of butchered adults in the Sacred Ridge region of Colorado have concluded that the butchers were all children, indicating that they wiped out the adults of their village in a single orgy of blood, perhaps as revenge for the practice of child sacrifice. And horror story number four. Scientists examining the fully articulated and deliberately buried remains of a 3,000-year-old Scottish man and woman discovered that they were actually reassembled from the remains of six unrelated people.
Oh, man.
What?
Richard, will you go first for everybody?
Thank you very much. Trouble is, I was making notes as you were speaking, and I've put false next to all of them.
Just change one of them.
I'll just change one of them.
I'll change three of them. Change three of them.
I'll change something. I have to change my underwear after hearing those horrible stories. Okay, I think what I'm going to go with, although, wow, they're all pretty interesting. Number three, they're all far-fetched, I think, but number three to me seems to be really far-fetched because I just can't see children overcoming a group of adults and butchering them. I think the adults would have something to say about that. Although I'm tempted to also say number one simply because how would they know they were eaten raw by other humans? That sounds unlikely, but strangely, who knows, that could happen. I think I'm going to have to say that number three is the fake.
The children butchers.
Yeah.
Okay. Evan?
Eaten raw by other humans. Okay, Neanderthals eaten raw by other humans. Well, they didn't get along, did they, now, humans and Neanderthals?
It could be other Neanderthal and other Neanderthals. Not necessarily modern humans, humanoids, you know, could be other Neanderthals.
All right. Well, you know, again, there were clearly conflicts occurring between the humanoids of that time. So, you know, the fact that they were killed is not also surprising. The eaten raw part is the sticker there that could mean that one's wrong. But I don't know. The next one about the Egyptologist, he discovered a method for preserving flesh by turning it into stone. Okay. Flesh to stone.
That's right, a third level spell.
Dungeons and Dragons, I was going to say. And, but remains a mystery and has never been duplicated. Well, I suppose that could be the case. The third one about the children butchering the adults, perhaps as revenge for the practice of child sacrifice. It's an interesting story. Richard brings up a good point that how realistic would it be for children to really overcome all the adults in the village? I mean, that would take quite a set of, quite a lot of, you'd think, coordination and planning on the part of the children. I just don't know that they would have it in them. But the last one, buried remains of a 3,000-year-old Scottish man and woman, that they were actually reassembled from the remains of six unrelated people. So perhaps this one was a part of a ceremony of some sort that took place 3,000 years ago, in which, I don't know, it's kind of this Tomb of the Unknown Soldier sort of thing. If you found all these parts and you do your best in putting them all sort of back together, if you find a left leg here and a right leg there and something else over there, it could have been some ritualistic thing. So I don't know. I think am I going to agree with Richard here on the children? That does seem like probably the most far-fetched one. Oh, no, that stone one, the petrification one, that one's far-fetched too. I'll say, well, Richard, I'm going to join you and say that it's the children one because I just can't see that they would have wiped out all the adults in the village. Now, maybe they did go on the attack, but they would have really had to coordinate it tightly. Everyone was asleep at night or something in order to do it, and I don't think that's going to hold up.
Well,
so, fiction.
Modern children with their cell phones, they could do it, I suppose, but...
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the first one here about the cannibalism. Now, so you're saying 12 Neanderthals, 3 children, and 3 teenage Neanderthals, right? Not mixed, a mix. It's all like a tribe or whatever.
Yeah, it's like a family.
Okay,
extended family.
Eaten raw by other humans, by humans. I would be surprised if this type of stuff didn't happen from time to time because, you know, food gets low. You know, it's, you know, especially, you can imagine back then. I mean, it would be, you know, that's it. You got to do what you got to do. It's horrible, but not surprising. So I think that one's true. So the second one here is about the, what is this? The flesh turning into stone. Oh, okay. So the guy discovered a method for preserving flesh. Okay. And it remains a mystery. Well, flesh to stone. I mean, it sounds so cliche, doesn't it? I mean, I understand the process of petrification. I mean, it does happen in nature. Okay, I mean, yeah, that's a little odd. This third one, about the children, and they turn on the evil parents who were sacrificing them, and they had an orgy of blood. That is weird. Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm sure that something stranger has happened, but this one is really weird. I mean, I can see why Evan and Richard picked that one, because I don't like the line in there, the orgy of blood, but this one is pretty interesting. And finally, the last one, the fully articulated 3,000-year-old Scottish man, and he was actually reassembled from the remains of 6 unrelated people. That's really weird too. Okay, so between the third and the fourth, okay, these are the two. It's got to be one of these. I will go with, all right, I am going to definitely go with the last one and say that one is the fiction. They did not build a person out of 6 unrelated corpses.
And Rebecca.
The orgy of blood. Come on. No way.
Okay. Fiction. All right.
Okay. Wow.
Damn!
That was quick.
That was...
Let's take these in order, then. In the El Cedron Cave in Spain, archaeologists found the remains of 12 Neanderthals, 3 children, 3 teenagers, and 6 adults. All 12 were killed, butchered, and eaten raw by other humans. You guys all think that this one is science, and this one is science.
Yes!
Very interesting. So, how do they know, you might ask?
How do they know?
Well, so by examining the bones, they look at the bones.
Look at the bones. No way.
Bones.
So
out of here with that.
They found a cave, but probably the family was living on the surface, and then after they were killed and butchered, their bone the floor collapsed down into a cave and took their bones with it, and that's how they ended up down in the cave. But they can look at the bones and they can see, first of all, that there are markings on the bones that indicate that they were killed with stone weapons. They have cut marks, grooves. They have stone flakes embedded in the bone, and then other microscopic features that indicate that it was stone weapons that killed them. They know that they were eaten because of also markings could indicate that their flesh was taken off the bones. The bones were broken open and the marrow sucked out, and the skulls were opened up so they could eat the brains. And there's no indication of any cooking, no fire, no burned or scorched bones.
So they probably
did it raw.
Oh boy.
Right.
They were able to examine the bones, and they indicated that those 12 individuals were nutritionally challenged for a long time. So what they think happened is that just in that region, that the food was very scarce. This family was not getting a lot of food. Their next door neighbors at some point decided, all right, you know, we're out of food. We got to kill the neighbors and eat them. You know,
time to kill the neighbors.
So they wiped out the whole family, all 12, ate them up, left their bones to be discovered.
Thousands of years later.
Yeah. This has happened about 42 to 45,000 years ago. This happened. Yeah. Hey. So times back then were tough.
Long enough ago that we can make jokes about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Too soon.
Yeah.
Too soon. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's move on. Number 2, Italian Egyptologist Girolamo Sagatto discovered a method for preserving flesh by turning it into stone. This process of petrification from almost 200 years ago remains a mystery and has never been duplicated. You all think that one is science, and that one is also science.
Yeah.
So far, so good. So yeah, this guy became fascinated by mummies when he was visiting Egypt, and he was also a chemist and had some other skills, a mathematician, etc. Trial and error figured out how to take, you know, actual flesh, not just the bones, but the flesh of a corpse, freshly dead corpse, and turn and mineralize the tissue, turn it essentially into stone, mm-hmm. and use that as a way of preserving it, as mummifying it. And he did this to a number of specimens. He has a pair of petrified women's breasts.
What?
A couple of heads.
And petrified women's breasts, you know what you need for those. Come on.
Waiting. Petrified hands?
No, an over-shoulder boulder holder. Thank you, Anne. Good night.
Good, Richard.
Oh, wow.
Very good.
I am impressed, sir.
Now, he died unexpectedly at the age of 44.
What happened, Steve? Come on.
45.
And he got sick and died. And before he died, he destroyed all of his notes, and he took the secret of his petrification process to the grave.
Why do they do that? Why?
And no one has been able to achieve the same results that he has in all that time. Some people have sort of come close, but no one's been able to get his results. Very interesting. We'll have a link. You could go to the virtual museum and see all of his specimens. They're pretty creepy looking. All right. Time for the money.
Yep.
And number three, archaeologists examining the prehistoric remains of dozens of butchered adults in the Sacred Ridge region of Colorado have concluded that the butchers were all children, indicating that they wiped out the adults of their village in a single orgy of blood, perhaps as revenge for the practice of child sacrifice. Before I give you the answer, have any of you heard of the Sacred Ridge Massacre?
No.
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 Okay, you will.
What?
This one is the fiction.
I was going to pick that. Oh,
but it's based on something.
But it's based on a horrific event. Yes. So the Sacred Ridge genocide, essentially, the entire population was completely wiped out. Everyone was killed. But not only that. Archaeologists found in this one location 15,000 bits of people.
Oof.
They were able to identify 33 different people. So that means each person on average was divided into 450 different pieces.
Jesus.
These people were literally butchered. They were chopped up into little pieces. Into this one mass horrific grave. But they weren't children killing adults. It was probably one group of people massacring another group of people.
Right.
Yeah.
Still creepy, right. But still not creepy. As creepy.
Sacred Ridge in Colorado, Native American settlement consisting of 22 pit houses. One of them was their murder pit, apparently.
Wow.
We call that the
genocide pit. Yeah. Don't let the name fool you.
It's more of a bowl.
It's more of a bowl, but yeah. Okay. All of this means that scientists examining the fully articulated and deliberately buried remains of a 3,000-year-old Scottish man and woman discovered that they were actually reassembled from the remains of six unrelated people. That is science. Very interesting. So the scientists, these were bog people. You guys familiar with the bog people?
Yeah.
Come on. Now you're making this stuff up. No. Seriously.
The bog people.
No,
it's like the melon heads.
No, there are bog mummies. There are bog mummies. If you throw a body into the bog, it's so low in oxygen that, first of all, the acids in the bog will tan the skin and the low oxygen will really, really preserve the skin well. Although the acidity is not so kind to the bones. So bog mummies have, they're really dark tan skin, like red hair. They are, very, very well preserved soft tissues. And their bones are not as well preserved.
I fell into a Wikipedia hole on bog people once, and like looking at the photos, it's really creepy. It's a fun thing to do at night when you can't sleep.
Yeah.
It bogged you down?
I thought you got bogged down, yeah. I thought that bog zombies would be a cool monster, right?
Yeah. Or rock band name.
Yeah, bog zombies, yeah. Bog zombies. So they had these two skeletons that were obviously deliberately buried, and they just didn't make sense. They couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. Things were just not fitting together well, even though they were two complete, fully articulated and posed buried skeletons, you know, from about 3,000 years ago. So then they decided to do DNA testing on the different bones, and they realized that these two individuals were actually stitched together from six different people that were not even related to each other. It wasn't a family or anything. There was no relation. So these were Franken-zombies or Franken-mummies. They were Franken-mummies.
Bog Franken mummies.
Bog Franken mummies. So they have no idea what led to this. The other interesting thing is that these bodies were thrown in the bog for only long enough to preserve the skin, and then they were removed. So they were removed before the bones would have been really destroyed. And
so
then
they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, so it seems like they put the bodies in the bog for a year or two. When they got really good, well-preserved, they took them out, stitched them different parts together, and then buried them in the sort of reassembled body parts. So it does seem like a ritual of some sort,
yeah.
You know. But although, so some of the bodies, I think the bodies were buried 300 to 600 years after death. So they were, wow. They were, not only did that process happen, but there was a large gap between them being turned into bog mummies and the being stitched together in the, as a Frankenmummy. So whatever. It's interesting. Yeah. So
sounds like a great Halloween costume, huh?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Bog zombie.
Complex.
Bog zombie. Very cool. So yeah, those are all really creepy. There was a couple other creepy stories too. There was a few other ones. The inspiration for this came from Cracked, which had the 6 archaeological discoveries scarier than any horror movie. And that article was sent to me by listener Jen Schumann. So thanks for forwarding that along. But there's a couple others that I didn't use from that list. One was in Egypt, in this one location, they found a pit that was filled with just hands.
Gross.
Left hands?
Right hands. They were all right hands. But there was only 16. So I'm like, okay, well, that's still interesting.
Oh, that's insane.
But it, you know, but, and what, but the archaeologists know why that is, because it was actually...
They were thieves.
No, nope. It was customary for soldiers who killed the enemy on the field of battle to cut off, or captured an enemy, to cut off their right hand and present it to their king, who would then reward them with gold. And then the king...
The right hand of the people.
Then they would throw the hand in the pit. Yep, so...
Okay, so it's a trophy.
Yeah, it was a trophy. Yeah. They were trophies from war.
I think scalps were used in the same way by the British in North America, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, so I thought that was a good Halloween themed science or fiction.
I really enjoyed it.
Richard, good job. You're 100% yes. This year.
Thank you. keeping up my wonderful standard, I think. Well, I'm not sure how many I've won and lost over the years, but I'm glad I won today.
All right, Jay, do you got a quote for us?
I do. I have a quote sent in by a listener whose last name I can't pronounce. It's Fred Quisian. Okay, so FK has sent a wonderful quote. FK is from New York State. And the quote is, "Biographical history, as taught in our public schools, is still largely a history of boneheads, ridiculous kings and queens, paranoid political leaders, compulsive voyagers, ignorant generals, the flotsam and jetsam of historical currents. The men who radically altered history, the great creative scientists and mathematicians, are seldom mentioned, if at all." And that is from Martin Gardner!
He's right.
Yeah.
Was right.
He should have said the men and women who radically altered history, but.
And I like his use of flotsam and jetsam.
You don't hear enough of that anymore, do you? Flotsam and jetsam.
Yeah, no, you don't. It's very cool, though.
And Martin Gardner was an American popular mathematics and popular science writer with interests also encompassing micromagic, scientific skepticism, philosophy, religion, and literature.
His books are still classics.
I have a few over on my shelf.
Worth a read, definitely.
Thank you, Fred.
Well, Richard. Thanks for coming on the show. We really look forward to seeing you in a few weeks.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much, Richard. And to round off some late exciting news for me personally, as I think I mentioned earlier in the show, James Randi will be touring Australia. He's going to be in Perth, Adelaide, Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney at the beginning of December. And I've been engaged by the organizers to host the tour in Perth and Adelaide and introduce the night in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. So that's wonderful. I was chatting to Randy earlier today and we're both looking forward to it immensely. If people want to come along and see James Randi, an evening with James Randi, which includes the viewing of An Honest Liar, the documentary, or people just have to visit thinkinc.org.au, and Randy and I'll be looking forward to seeing everybody at the venues.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, brother.
Steve. Thank you.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.